Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. Thanks for joining us today. It is September 21st, 2017. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. We want to thank you for joining us and thank our affiliates, KEPW.org, for sharing our station, our radio show on their station. Today we have back a friend of our show, Mr. Chuck Johnson from Oregon Physician for Social Responsibility. Last we spoke, he was headed off to Europe for a conference to stop nuclear war and nuclear weapons around the world. So thanks, Chuck, for joining us. Thank you for returning.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. So I'm super curious, what happened when you went to, what was the net result of the conference that you went to? And what was it?
Our listeners? Yeah, it was International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which is the international wing of the organization I work for, Physicians for Social Responsibility. It was founded during the Cold War by physicians in the United States and Russia, or the Soviet Union, to create citizen diplomacy at a time when our governments were threatening one another. Particularly the U.S. government with the incoming Reagan administration was quite aggressive and was talking about surviving nuclear war and making war plans. So it was a very threatening time. During the startup of the organization, they formed branches around the world. Ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 for contributing to the atmosphere of reconciliation between the United States and the Soviet Union that eventually led to the intermediate range missile treaty, withdrawing the most threatening missiles from Europe, and the end of the Cold War eventually. So this organization has continued along, has tried to remain relevant after the end of the Cold War. People began not to worry so much about whether or not we would die in a nuclear attack and moved on to other issues. But unfortunately, the weapons are still there. And as this current president is emphasizing, we still have the capacity in the United States and in Russia, and even if in a more limited attack with other countries, of killing. As a matter of fact, an attack between India and Pakistan would create enough dust physically, just in addition to the millions who would die in the attack, that they estimate up to 2 billion people could die of starvation just from crop failure just from a nuclear war between those two countries, who have much fewer missiles than the United States and Russia do. So obviously, with the situation with Korea, the world is having demonstrated for it that this issue is still a really important one to address. So this conference was in York, England, and from the 2nd of September to the 6th, it was co-sponsored by the IPPNW chapter MedAct, which is sort of PSR's equivalent in Great Britain. And I was able to go because I'm actually starting a new job in January with IPPNW in Boston. I'm going to be their program director. Longtime program director, John Loretz, is retiring, and I was selected to replace him. So I'll be leaving the Northwest probably temporarily. We expect to come back here and retire when I'm ready for that. But for the next several years.
You're going to be in Boston. Wow. Well, yep. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Really great. It's going to be a big loss for this organization here. But
we've got plans on that. We'll talk about that later. But yeah, we're not giving up on the work that we're doing on nuclear power by any means.
Let me ask you about the UN statement by our president. What did you say? That wasn't anywhere near reconciliation or let's, make an effort to be diplomatic. I found that speech to be quite aggressive, typical bully talk, but I don't know how you felt about it. What did you think?
Well, very much. It was not well received in the UN. It's kind of unusual for a U.S. president to give a speech in the UN and not get much applause, but he actually got almost none in his entire talk. He is not a well-liked person worldwide, but unfortunately, he is in charge of the world's largest military, and at least the equal to Russia's capacity as well, nuclear weapons capacity. So yeah, it was a very concerning. All of his talk about North Korea has been extremely concerning, because you don't really know with someone as unpredictable as Donald Trump where his actual boundaries are and if he actually has it.
Well, not only that, it's obvious he has no concept of the power he wields and the harm he could create. I mean, he's beginning to get that he has power, that he is the president, but he has no regard for the harm that he causes. None. Zero.
Doesn't strike me as a very compassionate man. No. The loss of tens of millions of people of lives are of less concern to him than any of us should be comfortable with, I think. And then on the other side, we've got a Korean dictator who was he's the grandson of the original leader. They don't have any sort of open political process there at all. And they have,
well, they're still at war. This is
a military-based dictatorship. So it's very concerning on that end as well.
Yeah, the whole thing. But so look, what is that? The organization that what's the name of the, it's the same organization that you're going to, right? You're just going to sort of a different office.
Well, it's funny, a lot of times the international organization is sort of considered the parent of the national organization, but PSR in one form or another has been around since the 1960s. Physicians for Social Responsibility, and IPPNW was formed in 1981.
Oh, so, okay.
The international group was formed later after the national group.
Okay.
But the international group got the Peace Prize. The national group, we take, we feel free to go ahead and claim it ourselves as well, because since we're part of the international, but it was actually the work that the international group did that received the Peace Prize in 85.
Okay, so this is, I think we sort of touched on this. When you went to this conference, did anybody talk about the waste that is the oppressive issue that is really like at risk in a war zone? Like, this is a big thing, I think, that we have all this waste and they are all potential targets. Don't you think? It could seriously be.
I think operating nuclear reactors are even more of a danger than waste dumps, although, you know, anything that has material in it is potentially a military target, depending on how nasty an adversary decides they want to be.
Oh, you mean the as far as military targets, like in war, nuclear reactors, operating nuclear reactors are more of a military threat than the waste.
Yeah, because you have two things. One, you knock out your opponent's electrical generation, and two, you basically have unleashed a nuclear weapon and contaminated an area.
Yeah.
You know, and there's been some concern that might happen in Ukraine. They don't run there. You know, they're the home to Chernobyl, and they have a bunch of these old Soviet era reactors operating there. And there was a time when a couple of them were in danger of being part of the war zone in the civil war that's going on there.
That was just a couple of years ago. That was when Russia was taking over. I remember there was some discussion. And that seemed to settle down, that it did not become, even the people who were participating in war understood. I don't think it was ever discussed, but it never really became an issue, did it?
No, and I think you're right. I think they realized that targeting that, for one thing, you can't control where that radiation spreads. Let's say you'd love to have your opponent get irradiated, you know, if you're in a war. Personally don't like to think in those terms myself, but when you blow up a nuclear reactor, depending on where the wind's blowing, you could be contaminating your own population and all the neighboring states. It's
exactly,
and it would not be great public relations, you know, for Russia or Russian rebels, Russian-backed rebels, to blow up a Ukrainian nuclear power plant. That would have been worse than shooting down a jetliner, which they apparently accidentally did as well during that time. So they, chose not to do it, which is good. You know, I mean, Osama bin Laden decided not to attack a nuclear power plant in the United States. There was some discussion prior to 9/11, apparently.
The big Osama bin. Don't get me going on that whole Osama bin Laden.
Well, you know, that they were thinking. They were thinking that rather than attacking the Twin Towers, just a second. They were thinking that rather than attacking the Twin Towers, that they might attack the Indian Point nuclear power plant and contaminate the entire New York City metro area with the reactor meltdowns. But they decided that that would be so extreme that the United States might drop a nuclear weapon on them in Afghanistan. So they decided not to do it. So far it hasn't happened, but it could.
You believe that story is real?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's a really logical thing. If you're going to try to do damage to somebody.
Yeah, but I do not believe for a second that Osama bin Laden did that whole thing at 9/11. He may have decided not to blow up a nuclear power plant. That might be part of the seed, but he didn't blow up the two plants, those two buildings in New York. He might have gotten money to be blamed for it. I don't know, but he did not have anything to do with it, in my opinion. But let's get back to your conference.
All right.
Punch my button there, brother.
I don't agree with you, by the way, for the record.
I know that's the record. For the record, actually, you buy the record.
I'm not saying that there wasn't some foreknowledge on the part of some U.S. officials. I believe that there was, that something was happening, and possibly even more detailed knowledge than has come out. But yeah, anyway, I just don't agree that the people who actually were blamed for it weren't involved in it. They actually, you know.
Okay. There's plenty of evidence that they were. Let's just move on. Even if they were, they weren't the part of it. But I want to hear about the conference. Like, what was the goals of the conference and what was agreed upon? Because that's where you went for, right? It was like a thing that they were proposing, or were you just, were they just panels of people sharing information?
It was mostly panels of people sharing information. Some strategy sessions kind of happening in between, you know, where groups were making, would sit and kind of talk through about next steps. But the main theme of it was the success in July of the nuclear ban treaty in the United Nations. The IPPNW and a number of other groups internationally have been working through an umbrella organization called ICAN, International Campaign mm-hmm. Against Nuclear Weapons. That group has been spearheading an effort in the United Nations to get beyond the limitations of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the frustrations that the non-nuclear states have had with the nuclear states over that treaty. Because in the old non-proliferation treaty, nuclear non-proliferation treaty, the non-nuclear states would agree not to develop nuclear weapons, and but the nuclear states also had a responsibility to negotiate themselves down to zero, and that just obviously hasn't happened. So about 10 years ago, IPPNW and some of the other groups that have been working on these issues internationally formed this ICAN group in order to promote the idea that the UN adopt its own separate treaty itself, you know, rather than wait for the nuclear weapons powers to do something, go ahead and be proactive and just ban nuclear weapons along the lines of what was done with the international ban on landmines.
Right, exactly.
You know, where you had a international agreement and you didn't necessarily have signatories from the nations that were the worst offenders initially with landmines. But over time, what's happened is countries have been observing that treaty because otherwise they look like rogue renegade states.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, nuclear weapons are a different game than landmines. I don't think anybody's kidding themselves that it's going to be as simple as it's been with the landmine treaty to try and get nuclear weapon states to cut back and reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons. But at least at this point, it looks as though the international norm is going to be that nuclear weapons are an illegal weapon. And 122 countries were voted to enact this treaty. And one voted no. That was the Netherlands. They were the one NATO country that participated in the discussion, and they ended up voting no. And then Singapore abstained, and the other 122 that were present at the time of the vote voted yes. So none of them, of course, are nuclear weapon states, and also none of them are allies, are the close military allies of the United States. So we still have a long way to go. But they just opened for signing the on the 20th, which is today, actually. Today? Or was that yesterday?
That was yesterday. Today is the 21st.
That was yesterday. Okay. So the treaty is now that the UN is back in session, the treaty is open for signature, and they're hoping to get as many of the countries that were among those 122 to sign officially sign that they support it, and then ratify. Once you have 50 countries sign and ratify the treaty, then it goes into force internationally. And they expect, we heard the Austrian ambassador to the UN speak in York, and he said, and he, Austria has been one of the countries leading this effort. He said that they expect it'll take about a year. So sometime by the end of next year, we should have the treaty in force. and at that point then can begin to focus our efforts on some of these military treaty countries that are under the nuclear umbrella of the United States primarily. And maybe even one of the nuclear weapons states.
Chuck, don't you think fundamentally that the reason that they want the nuclear weapons is, I think they think they're going to use the nuclear, they want nuclear weaponry to gain space superiority. Isn't that where that whole Star Wars program, that's going on. It's headed. It has not been held back. It's been kept off budget and separate things. And it's now, they're sort of coming out about it. It's pretty well known. And isn't nuclear a vital part of that? They hope to use nuclear energy in their ventures to dominate the space.
Well, nuclear energy and nuclear weapons are treated differently.
Yes, but that whole thing, they view the nuclear weapons as a vital part. The nuclear energy, they view it as a necessary part to, space superiority, so to speak.
Nuclear weapons, I don't think that it really is, because you don't need a nuclear weapon to knock out somebody's satellite capacity. You just need accurate, reliable
artillery,
conventional weapons, or lasers, or whatever it is, whatever high tech thing you figured out.
I mean, the reason I'm going this way is it just seems so unbelievable that they know the same facts, the same things. Science is science. We know that it's harmful. You know what I'm saying? To all living life. The waste, the byproduct of the electricity and the detonation of nuclear weaponry is just incomprehensible in scale. So I keep searching for a reason why these people in power are pushing it. Like, what is the problem? I cannot comprehend it. Because for our country to not sign on to, the nuclear, nuclear non-proliferation act. I mean, this is... It's incomprehensible that our country is the leading force in the war machine.
Well, it's pretty comprehensible when you consider that this is what empires generally do. You know, our behavior is very standard. We like to think of the America as being exceptional. You know, we hold ourselves to supposedly higher standard, and we're exceptional nation, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, we're just pretty typical. We just behave like any other empire. You have a military advantage and you don't get rid of it. You know, you use it to get other countries to do what you want. It's just, the trouble is that this isn't like having chariots, you know, versus the people who don't. You know, this is a scale which we could actually, our military superiority threatens the viability of the planet to sustain life.
Yeah.
You know, if we actually had a full-scale nuclear war. And it's just horrific genocidal weapons. But our capacity as a country to delude ourselves about our quote, goodness, end quote, allows us to say, well, okay, of course we have these weapons, but, you know, we're the good guys, and we have to have them, protect ourselves from the bad guys. And that's what every country says. The people that have them.
That's what Kim Jong-un
says. North Koreans
are
saying that about us right now, obviously.
That's exactly. I mean, this is the reality about North Korea. They're still at war. And for our president to dip his foot in there, he drew a line in the sand with Kim Jong-un and said, if you do anything, we're going to go after you. Well, then he did something. And he keeps doing something. So it's like... this is really the frightening part is the response from our leader, because he really is an abuser. He'll keep you going and then boom, he's going to slam it hard when you least expect it. And that is the thing that really this is serious business, and it's directly related to the conference that you went to in England about how do we prevent this type of heavy-handed, hot-tempered. I mean, are these delegations actually go and lobby the White House and talk to them about things, like, and talk to the military? I mean, how deep does this go, or is there any influence on government?
It's been pretty hard to do it, and the Trump administration, I don't think, is very promising ground at all. What's sad is that we had 8 years of Barack Obama, who claimed he was for nuclear disarmament, gave a great speech for his first year in office in Prague, and then he basically did nothing. You know, he wasted 8 years. He just continued our same military doing the same things, actually made a promise to the Senate that he would set up our ability to build and test nuclear weapons through the end of this century, this current century we're in, you know, a $100 billion program to renovate our nuclear weapons capacity. You know, I mean, this is the thing that's under Barack Obama. People in the departments who are allegedly our friends and pals, who just basically were cowardly. That's about all I can really say about it. I don't want to speak too harshly at this point because they're no longer in office.
It would be nice
if some of them would help us now in getting to zero belatedly. But they had more of a chance when they were in office, and particularly in his second term when he didn't have to run for reelection, to have done something, and they really didn't. They opposed this treaty, nuclear weapons ban treaty, and tried to muscle other countries into not participating.
He's very pro-nuclear. This is the thing. Think about this. The Republicans in 07 mandated that in 2012 we spend $35 billion on nuclear in 2012. That was written into law in 07. When it came around in 11, Barack Obama skedaddled and got $100 billion. Instead of $35 billion and resisting that, he dug in and got $100 billion. When Fukushima happened, he lied to us and said everything is fine and took a three-week vacation to South America. We have emails from Hillary Clinton telling her staff to stay inside for a few weeks, take your clothes off. So this, you know, the Barack Obama has no love lost in my view. I mean, this is the sad part, Chuck. We have these degradations of bad to, you know, really horrible, which is what we have now, to just plain, you know, colluded, coerced bad. I mean, they are cowards. They truly are cowards. And you're right about us propping ourselves up and saying how great we are, because honestly, we need a little come to Jesus moment with ourselves and look in the mirror. I think that's what Trump is doing. Trump is making us look in the mirror. I think
he is. Yeah, you know? He is. He is sobering. Not just to us, but to the rest. The rest of the world sees us much more clearly as a result of Trump. Because Obama, you know, he could make even the worst things we were doing seem reasonable because he's a very intelligent, charming man. He balances some of the worst things he was doing with doing some good things so that people could say, well, you know, maybe it's all right. With Trump, you know, there isn't any upside. There's no charm, certainly. Not for me, anyway. For a certain segment of the U.S. population, unfortunately, he is very charming. They like a bully. They want somebody who's going to lash out and express some of the frustration they're feeling with, you know, their own lots in life. I think that's really what it is. He's tapped into a part of America that is not done particularly well in recent years, and is ready to blame immigrants and foreigners and, you know, whoever else they can trump up, no pun intended, to, you know, to put the blame on, or Barack Obama. Apparently, I just heard music.
You did. That was my cell phone. I forgot to turn the sound down. I beg your pardon. It though.
Yeah. So, the good side of this is if we don't end up in a nuclear war, you know, which we're at risk, greater risk than ever right now, that at least people now realize that this is a significant issue. You know, climate change is a catastrophic issue in that's slowly happening before our eyes.
This is something that could happen very suddenly,
you know, that's equally threatening.
This is really, I've been really piqued by this, thinking about that term, because it's a political banter thing that people say. I don't believe in climate change. I believe in climate change, man-made climate change. I think what we're seeing is an environmental collapse. Our climate is changing because the environment's collapsing because of the degradation from sheer gross neglect by the industrialists, by the capitalists, just complete degradation, environmental degradation that is collapsing everything. And it is,
right.
I mean, it's an urgent issue. If you go to end times, you can just mass animal deaths 2017 and Google that. Take a look. Go to the first links. Take a look at the millions and millions of fish that are washing up on shores every month. We're not talking once a year. We're losing a million birds a month. A million birds a month are dying. Uncounted fish. Just the other day, I read a story on my show about 13 whales popped up dead, and they all had plastic in their stomach.
Yeah.
A whole pod just died. I mean,
I know we're the environment is getting attacked on multiple fronts. You know, it isn't just overheating from the carbon being burned, but it's, you know, it's everything else, you know, that we're doing.
The nuclear because contamination. We have such, it's right. all of it. It's all, we can't, and that's the interesting thing. It's almost like this devious little plan of like, we'll just do it all so they can't blame any one of us. I can see like five or six heads of these corporations like, yeah, they can't point to us because your stuff causes it too. You know what I mean? Like, it's a devious little plan. And actually, they use that on people when they want to go get their medical benefits. I mean, the people in NUMEC in Pennsylvania that won their case, against the being poisoned and contaminated with uranium. The judge recently said, well, you have to prove to us how much what exact radioactive contaminant you got sick from and how much did you get in order for the benefits to pay off. Can you believe that? And that is where they're going. They're using technicalities on people.
That's how it's always been in the nuclear area and in some other contaminants where it's, you know, you have diseases, but it's not easy to trace it to specific sources. It could have come, you know, theoretically in some other way. Mm-hmm. I know that the Navajo uranium miners, ended up eventually losing their lawsuits to try and get compensation for all the lung cancer they had because most of them were smokers, you know. Mm-hmm. So it probably didn't help that they were both breathing in radon and smoking cigarettes. Mm-hmm. But the uranium mining companies got off scot-free for exposing these workers to radon, not giving them masks to breathe through or anything else to try and protect them. Because they could say, oh, well, they're smokers. Of course, they got cancer. You can't prove they got cancer from radon. So, we're scot-free. And that's the kind of thing that does happen. Sort of the exception to the rule is nuclear weapons workers under a law that was passed when Clinton was just about to go out of office. One of the good things he did as he was leaving office was basically say if a disease, you know, potentially could have been caused by something that these nuclear workers were exposed to while they worked, then they can get compensated for that disease. Now, they still have to go through a really, you know, difficult rigmarole to try and get that compensation. But they paid out, you know, I think somewhere around $9 billion to former atomic workers in the weapons complex. And so, you know, if you hear people say that nuclear is safe and nobody ever gets harmed by it, well, our government disagrees. It's paying people serious money for the health effects that they experience as a result of working in the nuclear weapons complex.
That's right.
So that is one example where a little bit of justice is happening, belatedly, of course, because these people still have the health effects.
Right. And their lives have been negatively impacted for the rest of their existence on this planet. So I want to, we have about a half an hour left. I want to talk to you about the Columbia Generating Station, which, you know, we talked about Robert McCullough. He had that report that said it was very expensive and they were going to go. And this was the last time we talked, it was going to be submitted. And it was pretty hopeful that this thing, they were going to be mandated to close down the Columbia Generating Station. What became of that? Because I didn't hear anything about it. And I looked around, it's been, so the, I guess this is a twofold question. What became of that? And then if you could spend a little time explaining how people can find out information about their own nuclear power plants. Because as you answer my questions about CGS, it's true for everybody else. So,
But, well, I don't know. I wasn't hopeful that it would lead to the immediate shutdown of the nuclear plant. So I don't know. I must have presented it in a particularly hopeful way that day. But because what we've found in 5 years of trying to get this plant shut down is that there's an emotional attachment to nuclear energy in the public power movement. This is a reactor that's operated by a consortium of 27 publicly owned utilities in Washington state. And they have this long history of supporting nuclear projects. They tried to build 5 nuclear reactors at the same time and completed only one of them. It was then called the Washington Public Power Supply System, or WPS was the acronym. And they regretted allowing that acronym after they had to default on 2 of those reactors and then cancel 2 others that are still being paid for through Bonneville rates. So 36% of our electric rates from Bonneville go to pay for nuclear projects. Most people don't realize that.
36%?
Yes.
That's huge.
Yeah. That's because the debt was enormous and they've had to roll it over a number of times in order to try and have enough capital to do other things like
the debt to
mitigation
whom?
And
the debt to whom?
The debt is to bondholders of the old WPS bonds are now Energy Northwest bonds. And they've, at this point, all the old debt is rolled over several times. They keep putting the ultimate payout date later as they get more, they negotiate for better interest rates and so forth. Right now is a good time. What is a good time for them to roll over all of their bonds? So they've done that, but they'll finish paying in 2028 for the 2 canceled reactors that were canceled in the 1980s. And then at that point, it'll just be the CGS, which is the Columbia Generating Station, which is the one reactor they did finish. And that debt will be paid off somewhere around 2045 is what they're projecting.
So 2045.
By 2028, their total nuclear bill will be significantly at that point. They'll at least have gotten rid of those 2. But they'll still have, you know, the albatross of the Columbia Generating Station.
But this
weighing
is the
down
issue.
Our rate.
At that point, it will be so old, it will be time to shut it down. It will not pay for itself.
Well, I think that's what's happening right now. So let's talk about Robert's report a little bit.
Yeah.
3 years ago, he found that if you shut down the Columbia Generating Station and replace power with power you could buy in the market, that you would save $1.6 billion, I believe it was, through 2028. And basically, his prediction has proven to be correct so far the last 3 years. As the years have gone by, the prices of power have remained really low. And the cost of running the Columbia Generating Station has continued to be pretty high. And so there's a gap between the two. Now, one of the things we ran into right off the bat was concern for climate issues, because one of the reasons why power is so cheap right now is that natural gas is being fracked, and the price of natural gas for generating electricity is really cheap. The other half of that equation is that wind has been really cheap, too. And in our region, we have quite a bit of wind, and it depresses the price of electricity. When the wind's blowing really hard, the price of electricity can sometimes even go negative. So this really puts the Columbia Generating Station at a disadvantage, because it can't turn itself off when the price is negative.
There
have been times when Bonneville's had to sell power at very disadvantageous moments for pay people to take our power, so with a dam, you can hold back the water and not generate electricity and take advantage of all that wind power, but you can't do that with a nuclear plant. So for all of these reasons, it sort of made sense to close this thing down just from an economic standpoint. But the opposition claimed that you'd have to replace it with an equally large sized gas plant, which is a canard. That's not true. We have enough electricity in the region and enough flexibility with all the water power that we have that you wouldn't need to replace the Columbia Generating Station 100% at all. But they make that claim, and if you
so
do
you're
use
essentially,
the market,
you're essentially saying that we sort of overproduce energy anyways, that we have the ability to create the energy when we need it.
Right. I think that's true. But if you were just going to buy power on the market, undoubtedly you would be burning some additional natural gas. So we asked Robert last summer to do a new calculation that would be based on just 100% replacing with renewables rather than allowing natural gas, or just going purely on price. And he found that because the cost of wind and solar has come down so much, with particularly utility scale solar in California, and now increasingly we have some in Idaho and other places. They're building a large solar facility in Lakeview, Oregon right now. The price is down to where it's competitive with the CGS. And in fact, we would save less money than he previously projected, but some money just by completely converting over to clean, renewable energy. So
this is why you're saying they're emotionally tied to the idea, because it doesn't make logical sense why they're not doing it. In other
words, I think actually I don't think that suddenly the public power movement got a conscience about climate change, because they've been burning gas for years and some of them are involved in coal plants.
Right.
But I think it's a convenient excuse for people who are emotionally attached to nuclear energy to say, you know, you people aren't really green. You know, here you are advocating closing something that has a small carbon footprint and replacing it with burning fossil fuels. You know, what kind of a green person are you? So we had to take that to heart, because climate change is a real problem, and you know, we don't want to be contributing to it. And so that's why we did the study. That was also what we had to do in order to pass our resolution in the Seattle City Council. The Seattle Municipal Utility, Seattle City Light, is one of the largest users of electricity in the Northwest. And it's also on the Energy Northwest Board. And their city government voted to close the Columbia Generating Station if and when it can be replaced by renewable energy. So obviously the study ties into that, and
then that means that they could shut it down right now, because it can be, if and when is now, it can be 100% replaced by renewable energy.
We're planning on having a conversation now with Seattle again, especially now that they their mayor was not someone who looked on us favorably, but he ended up coming along with the resolution as we passed it. he's about to go out of office, and
under scandal.
And depending on who's elected and how they look at us, we may have Seattle as an advocate rather than just a passive body that sort of half-heartedly agreed to our resolution.
You may know,
and we're beginning to work in Eugene as well. Now we're just starting to work in Eugene, Damon Mott Story, who's going to be my successor here at Oregon PSR, is going to be contacting groups in the Eugene area to have an organizing meeting and begin discussions of what it would take to get EWEB to take a position for closing the Columbia Generating Station. So I hope you and your friends can be involved in that as well.
Yeah, maybe we could bring that to KEPW, because Rick Gold and his Eugene Peaceworks, that's what KEPW means, right? Eugene Peaceworks.
Right.
They are really like one of the strongest anti-nuclear people that I know here in Eugene. They're the only people that actually, when I'll go out and do an action with a couple of my friends, they're there with their friends. That's how we all sort of got to know each other, because we all like, right on, man. You know what I mean? It's up to us to stand out and speak up, because really we can't just go, oh, well, no, we have to do whatever it is that we think we can do. That's the issue, and learn how to get better. This is one of the things I want to ask you. You mentioned to me, I know I read on the nuclear alerts that there was a potential uncontrollable radiation release at CGS that they had worked on, but the NRC report said, don't worry, it's all fine, as they usually do, right?
Where was this again?
At CGS. This was a couple weeks ago.
An uncontrolled release?
Yeah, it said potential. They always they put it there, potential uncontrollable release. They have
when
that all
that?
The time. I don't know, a couple weeks ago. It comes around. And that's when I asked you, because I went to their site. When you look at their site, they're 100%. But what you're saying is that we can find out, like at Columbia Generating Station, and everybody can do this with the nuclear power plant near you. Go and look.
Well,
go to the NRC website.
Right. That's true. You go to the NRC website and look at power operations. Go to their It takes a little bit of searching around, but they have, hang on, I can actually tell you what that is. Let's see, I've got it right here.
Yeah, I think you it's a drop.
It's reactor status. Just Google reactor status. When you're... Google it, but search it on the NRC Nuclear Regulatory Commission website.
Okay.
That should get you there. If you want to look at Columbia Generating Station and see exactly how much power it's generating at any given moment, there's a website, a Bonneville Power Administration website, that will show you. And it's https://transmission.bpa.gov, as in Bonneville Power Administration, .gov, /business/operations/wind/.
Oh, Lord, you're losing me on all these slashes. I'm just going to go there. That's like way too much slashes there. Okay. I'm at bpa.gov transmission.
It's under bpa.gov/transmission, and that should get you there.
To performance metrics, right? It gets us to performance metrics. Is that what we're looking for? Or historical flow data?
No, it's 5 minutes. It's real-time a listing of either wind, hydro, fossil, biomass, and nuclear generation.
Okay, so when we're on their website, we Google for what? Statistics? Operating statistics?
No, I would just Google bpa.gov/transmission, and then wind power, because this was originally created so that people could look at, because wind changes so much, they could see on a regular basis what was happening with the wind. But then they added a line for nuclear about a year ago. So you can see what the CGS is doing on this website now.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
So, but this is the point to figure out, because when it's down, now, is that a good thing when they go down? Like, to me, it seems like that means that they're fixing something. I mean, I don't trust any of these nuclear power facilities at all. I think they're all dangerous. They're all old. They've all been extended. None of them are really in great shape. There isn't a single one identical. Most of them are sitting on earthquake faults. I mean, it's incomprehensible, Chuck, to me when I look at, like, you're moving to Boston. There's nuclear power plants all around you in Boston.
Yeah, there's one at Seabrook, and there's one Pilgrim out near Plymouth Rock.
Yeah.
And Pilgrim's about to close. Hopefully it won't melt down before it closes.
Exactly. That's kind of what you have to live on there. I mean, that's the sad part. That is really, mm-hmm. I mean, this is the state of affairs. This is what prompts me to get up and do this radio show every day. To be honest, mm-hmm. people say, well, how can you do it? I'm like, I want to give voice to people who are out there understanding this. Like, it helps me to understand how to find these statistics, how to keep track of it. Because you start going to, like, the nuclear alerts. It says there's all the time these reports, the potential uncontrolled. I read an alert yesterday or the day before yesterday, I think, that said that they retracted an emergency because they realized that the leak was less than 10 gallons per minute.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 7 gallons per minute is not considered an emergency of a nuclear leak.
That's pretty bad. That seems like a pretty big leak to me. I mean, if it were in my house, that certainly would be a significant leak.
Yeah. So they retracted it because it said it wasn't 10 gallons GPM.
Oh.
It was like, wow. Because they
what this says, Lonnie? This is what's happening to the nuclear fleet in the United States. It's falling apart. You know, it's getting old. They're trying to run it for 60 years instead of the 40 that it was originally designed. The 40 was much more realistic. And at the far end of the 40, you're going to have things start to fall apart. That's what's happening at the CGS. The reason they were shut down for 2 weeks was that they had a failure of yet another valve. They keep having valves. Mm-hmm. Stick closed. This time it was inside the condenser, which cools down the water, condenses the steam and turns it back into water and allow it to be reused in cooling the reactor. And they lost the vacuum in their condenser. So they couldn't move the water through the condenser anymore because this valve closed and they couldn't get it open. So they had to shut down the reactor, obviously, because they couldn't cool the water to cool the reactor. And they did it normally. They didn't have to scram it, but they turned it down pretty fast. They turned it down from full power to zero in about 20 minutes.
Wow.
So that's, you know, that, and that kind of a turndown is pretty hard on a reactor. They usually try to do it over a day, or at least two days.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but none of these reactors were built to last 50 years. Their lifespan was 20 years. They were expected to be short term, that they were going to modernize. I think when they were built, they were
40 years. They were licensed for 40 years because they expected they could run them for 40 years. Yeah.
Originally licensed for 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that is outrageous. But, you know, in the 40 years, they haven't really come up with a way to, they haven't invested in their own products. This is why we have these problems, because they haven't figured out, they're not attempting to figure out a way to improve the system. They're trying to keep putting Band-Aids on a broken old system.
That's it. I mean, right now they're economically challenged, not just in the Northwest, but throughout the country. And so there are national efforts by the Nuclear Energy Institute to help these utilities about how to cut corners and cut costs and reduce the cost and be more efficient with their nuclear plants. Well, what that means is that we're going to see more and more of these plants are going to have experience problems because they're short circuiting some of the repair work that they should be doing if they're trying to, you know, operate safely.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a dangerous situation with bad economics putting pressure on the operation of these nuclear plants. Mm-hmm. And the same's happening here in the Northwest, because even though they claim that Robert McCullough is completely off and doesn't know what he's talking about, in reality, they are in conversation with the Bonneville administration, who has to buy their power, and who could ultimately, if there was political cover for him, they could close that reactor. It's just that so far, the only utility thus far that's even in a lukewarm way said that they want to do it is Seattle. So, you know, they understand they're kind of under the gun, that everybody knows they don't want to admit, because then it would be giving aid and comfort to the environmentalists that they're not economic, but everybody knows they aren't. So they're trying to cut corners and cut costs. And this, you know, this potentially is dangerous at the CGS, in my opinion. It's certainly, if not for a full-scale nuclear accident, but we can expect that they'll continue to have problems like this stuck valve, because they just are not going to shut down long enough to fix all the laundry list of things that they ought to be checking and fixing. So when every 2 years they shut down for refueling, and that's when you attend to a number of things that you know, have maybe put off fixing, because you can only fix it when the reactor's shut down. But they've tried to keep these shutdown times short in order to generate more electricity and prove that they're a viable, economic resource for the region. And when you do that, then that means some things just don't get looked at or fixed. And I think we're just going to see more and more of these. We've had three unplanned shutdowns at the CGS over the last 18 months, which is quite a few.
Yeah.
Normally, they just run continuously in between refueling. That's what they're designed to do. You aren't supposed to have these outages. But they've had three of them, so for various reasons. Some operator error, some nature breaking the link between Bonneville transmission lines and the CGS during the winter last year. But then that was compounded by mistakes that they made at the plant and uh-huh. damage that they did that they had to repair at the plant. So,
well, that's a pretty good sales job. I can't wait till you got your contact. What's his name? Marco? You said his name was Marco. I beg your pardon. The man taking over your job.
No, it's Damon.
Damon
Mott's story. Yeah, that's where the M comes from. He's got Damon a hyphenated last name.
Oh, okay,
Damon Mott's story. He's a wonderful, very energetic young man who
well,
was
I can't
working
wait till
for
he comes
us last
down
year.
Because we really, I mean, yeah. like you've impressed upon me the urgency of actually having this thing go away. So, look, we have less than a minute left. I want to thank you, Chuck, for coming on with us, because this is always a good conversation. And you know, interestingly, operation of a nuclear power generating station is almost as, I don't know, threatening as nuclear war. We can't untangle them, it seems to me. They seem to go hand in hand, although they're two different threats. But I really appreciate your conversation. I hope you can come back with us sometime soon.
Definitely. Whenever and once I get to Boston, I'll still be available so I can talk to you
That'd
about what's
really
happening
great.
On the nuclear weapons front.
That'd be really great. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Put your courage feet on. Take action. It really does matter that you take action. Listen to your own heart, because we are in a critical time, and it's up to us. And I think we can do it. We just need to listen to our inner selves and get busy. Talk to you tomorrow.
Right on. Thanks.
Bye, Chuck.
Bye.